The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. George Osborne makes his fourth full budget statement next week. But will he change the record?
This emergency budget deals decisively with our country's record debts. Last year's emergency budget was about rescuing the nation's finances and paying for the mistakes of the past. Today's budget is about reforming the nation's economy so that we have enduring
this
growth.
This budget supports working families and helps those looking for work. There is no other road to recovery.
As cabinet ministers, past and present, go public with their own economic plans, can he really maintain that there is no alternative? And as deficit hawks at the IMF seem to be going soft on austerity, is there anyone left to argue the case for expansionary fiscal contraction? Plus, with David Cameron facing cabinet-level challenges to his authority, how much is really at stake for him as well as his Chancellor when the red box is open next Wednesday? Also this week, we are the 99.8%, all bar three of the residents of the Falkland Islands vote to remain British, but will anyone listen? Joining me to discuss all of this, we have Andrew Lillico, who's Chair of Europe Economics, Duncan Weldon, who's Senior Economist at the TUC, and our Economics Editor, Larry Elliott. A warm welcome to you all. Now, if last year's omni-shambolic budget was remembered for pasty, charity and granny taxes, as well as cash handouts to the well-to-do, this year, George Osborne will be desperate to regain some credibility. In a year that's already seen Britain's AAA rating disappear amid grim GDP figures, no news may well be good news this time around. Larry Elliott, as the economics editor, you've been advising on writing the headlines on budgets for quite a while now.
Too long.
What areas do you think they're likely to focus on this week?
I don't think this is going to be a particularly dramatic budget. I think it will have probably be more of the same, that he will stick to his plan. He will say that he needs to keep fiscal policy tight and then keep a lid on public spending and prevent the budget deficit from increasing further than it's going to anyway, and leave the heavy lifting to be done by the Bank of England. That's essentially been government policy for the past 3 years, where all the easing of policy has been done by the Bank of England and the Treasury has tried to keep policy relatively tight. There's been some slippage, but generally that has been the focus of policy. It has to be said that the strategy has not been a particular success so far. I mean, there is pressure for a change, and I think there is some justification for those claims. And if you think about, if the government was a private business and was doing the same strategy year after year after year and it wasn't working, there'd be lots of Tory MPs saying it was time for a change of thinking at the top of the board. And I think that they probably have reached that point for quite a lot of Conservative MPs. And I think there is a very strong case now for saying that Osborne is mistaken in just carrying on with the same old failed policy.
So the headline would be he's staying the course, but other people aren't happy. Andrew, I mean, we big up these budgets in the Westminster Village as key moments of strategic decision for the government. George Osborne made a very big decision in 2010 when he first set out his plans about cutbacks and austerity. Do you think there's any more decisions really to be made this week, or is he just sticking with his plan?
I think a key lesson of major fiscal consolidations of the past has been that what you get done in the first 2 years is what you get done. And I think we saw that even in last year's budget, that the resistance that there was to any further rises in taxes was a key factor in the unravelling of last year's budget. I think that Osborne will be seeking, at least on the fiscal side, to be as boring as possible on this occasion. There may be a few little mentions of things on the personal allowance rising a bit further, meeting the 10,000 target, maybe even indicating that a willingness to go further in the future, might try something on corporation tax in order to placate the backbenchers, calling for some sort of movement on that. But I think that the key action, if there is any excitement, will lie on in terms of the Monetary Policy Committee's remit. I think that will be the focus. Does he announce at the end any sort of change to the Monetary Policy's remit, nominal GDP targeting, flexible inflation targeting, something to coincide with Mark Carney arriving?
So new man, new idea potentially as well. And so at the moment, just for background, the Bank of England's been charged for a long time now with targeting something like 2% inflation, has to adjust things if it's going to undershoot it as well as overshoot it. So it's meant to be a steady holding the course policy. And the big idea is saying, well, you target what the economists call nominal GDP, which means you target, yes, inflation a bit, but you also target growth a little bit as well.
Well, the inflation target has been 2% since 2003. In fact, in the period of inflation targeting, they've changed it twice. So it originally came in 1992. They changed it once in 97 and once in 2003. They may change the target in a variety of ways. Actually, I think nominal GDP targeting is one of the less likely things for them to do. Nominal GDP targeting has some very considerable drawbacks, particularly in that when you measure nominal GDP statistics, they're very unreliable, and then you change your mind on them later. It's also already the case that the government has set the Bank of England a growth aspect to what it's done. And so there is a growth element to the inflation target. So I don't think it's really that they're introducing growth into this tale. It would be more a matter of what kind of view you take on inflation over the medium term. What they're seeking to do is to find some way of committing to keeping policy very loose, even in a recovery phase, because they think that people will anticipate interest rates rising if the economy starts to recover, and that may stop them from investing as much as they would do today. I think that that's completely forlorn, and that there's no credible way of achieving that. So I think that all of though there are some improvements you could make to the Monetary Policy Committee's remit, I think that all of the ones which they have on the table are actually going to make things worse.
Blimey. So there might be a big idea, but it's a big idea that gets the thumbs down from you, Andrew.
Absolutely.
Duncan, I'm sure we'll come back to what we call fiscal policy to do with taxes and things. But just on this point now about Mark Carney, this Canadian who's been brought in with such high hopes. If George Osborne stands there and says, right, we're now fiddling with the inflation target, most people won't understand him. But if it does what Andrew's saying it's meant to do, and means that people believe that interest rates will stay low for a very long time, won't that be good news for the economy?
Well, I mean, you know, for a long time now, this has been George Osborne's strategy. His economic strategy has been tight fiscal policy, you know, the spending cuts, the tax rises, easy monetary policy, and alongside that, a very weak pound. That's his policy mix. And I think we will see at the budget that policy mix reiterated again, probably with some change to the Bank of England's mandate. Whether they actually change that at the budget or whether they announce a consultation to be done before Carney takes office in July, you know, we'll wait and see. But I think, you know, there is a worry here as to how effective monetary policy really can be in stimulating the economy at a time when interest rates are already very low, at a time when households are already very indebted, and at a time when the banking system isn't really working in terms of giving credit to small businesses, to large infrastructure projects. You know, Keynes famously called this pushing on a string. You know, that's the situation we're in. There isn't a monetary magic bullet, and changing the Bank of England's remit is no panacea to get growth going again.
I agree with Andrew. I think it could be actually quite dangerous. And one of the points that George Osborne makes about changing fiscal policy is that the markets might respond to it in a negative way, that if you actually cut taxes or you increase spending, that the markets would take fright at that and push up long-term interest rates. I think that there has to be a risk that the markets would respond unfavourably to changes to the Bank of England's remit, because Andrew's right, there have been two changes to the remit since 1992, but generally they've been to actually tighten the remit. It started as a 1-4% inflation target and then was moved to 2.5 and then was changed to a 2% target. This would be seen by the markets as a loosening of the target at a time when inflation is above target and has been above target for the best part of 4 years. So if your fear as a chancellor is that there is going to be some negative response from the financial markets to what you're doing, then there has to be a risk that changing monetary policy in this way is also going to lead to a real risk of a financial markets backlash. Probably more so, I would have thought, than an easing of fiscal policy, because it's quite clear. I mean, Duncan's right that we've had this mix and it's not working. The mix is wrong. I think the mix of fiscal and monetary policy is actually not doing the business for the economy.
Well, I have to say, just as a presenter to a podcast, I'm disappointed, because the joke is that you put three economists in a room and you get four views or whatever, but you all seem to be nodding that this big idea is a dangerous idea. Can't I just explore this a little bit more, Andrew? If people are worried that interest rates are going to go up, maybe because prices are starting to pick up for things that the UK can't control, because of, I don't know, rising wages in China and things like that, isn't it good if we're giving a signal to businesses who are planning on investing that interest rates will stay low, even if commodity prices and Chinese wages and other things that George Osborne can't hope to control start to go up.
What one could do is you could just say, look, we're going to have 10% inflation in a couple of years' time, and that would then get everybody unloading out of their cash and out of their fixed income into investment today, because they'll want to be in real assets to protect themselves from inflation. So you get yourself an investment boom going, like the government did in 1972. So in 1973 Q1, investment was 25% higher than in 1972 Q1, and GDP was 9.9% higher between those two periods. But of course, then we had 20% inflation shortly thereafter. The investors saw that as a bad signal. So if all that you care about is manipulating GDP a little bit so as to get George Osborne a bit of good economic news ahead of the next election, then fine, let's go and have lots of inflation promised down the line. But if we actually want to have a stable economy over the medium term, then that's not the way to do things. Inflation has been consistently too high. That has eroded the real value of household wages for a period. So we're seeing a bit of a realignment between capital and labour in the economy because of this. And I think that actually it's politically naive as well, because if we get inflation, nobody's going to blame anybody but George Osborne for that. He's been quite successful at blaming recession, tax rises, spending cuts and so on Gordon Brown. But inflation is something that's going to happen on his watch, and everybody will blame him for it.
I see. Okay, well, what if we've got to rule out this idea? Let's try this to get a bit of dissensus around the table. What should George Osborne do? I mean, do you think that his strategy is basically working, or basically not, Andrew?
His strategy is failing, mainly because he abandoned his original strategy. So his original strategy was to seek to eliminate the structural current deficit over one parliament. He made a big deal about how it wasn't credible if you didn't seek to do it over one parliament, but instead lay off much of the work into a latter parliament. And he abandoned that original strategy in late 2011. Almost as soon as he abandoned that, the UK government got put on downgrade warning by Moody's in response to his abandoning his original austerity programme. And when things didn't pick up, then we lost the AAA rating. So the thing about what I would say, you were asking earlier about what people say about expansionary fiscal consolidation, I say, well, it might have been worth a try. The reality is that what we've done here is exactly as Vince Cable characterises it, arch-Keynesian policies pursued over an extended period with a very gradualist fiscal consolidation attached onto the end of them. And I look, when I look at a policy over the past few years, I see enormous deficits with automatic stabilizers plus enormous structural deficits, so massive Keynesian injections into the policy, into the economy. And I see those not having produced growth. And I conclude from that that maybe they aren't working and we should try something else. Other people see those same enormous structural deficits and they say, what that means is we haven't done enough of them. Well, I find that an odd kind of a reaction to these events.
So if you were Chancellor, you'd be saying...
I'd be saying we hadn't cut spending fast enough. What he spent the first 2 years doing was to raise taxes and to cut back on capital spending and really to make no cuts to the underlying medium-term current spending at all. He's just starting to do some current spending cuts now. He doesn't have nearly enough of them detailed. And in fact, because the underlying growth rate of the economy is less than he thinks, he's going to actually have to schedule even more over the medium term if he's to meet any of his targets. And the reality is that in the end, to achieve any of his current spending targets, he's going to have to bite the bullet on the ring fences. So he's going to have to cut into the NHS, the schools and the pensioner benefits. And whilst those ring fences stay in place, I think it's also doubtful whether you actually deliver even on the spending programmes cuts which he has announced, because those departments are very resentful of the fact that they've been subject to enormous spending cuts, even though they hadn't had spending rising, whilst the very largest departments, which had the largest rises in spending, have been insulated from cuts.
I see. So you'd say that, like, rather than just accepting that things have got worse and so we had to spend a bit more on unemployment benefit and so on, we need to tell protected departments that they're going to get less now. Duncan, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, I struggle to describe George Osborne's policy as ultra-Keynesian. You know, we've had huge cuts to capital spending, we've had a rise in VAT, we've had large cuts to the social security benefits, particularly things like tax credits. We've lost about 500,000 public sector jobs over the last 2 years. This isn't what I would regard as a Keynesian policy. We should remind ourselves quite where the economy is. The economy today is no bigger than it was in 2006. Average wages are roughly where they were in 2002. Industrial production is where it was in 1992. You know, the economy is not doing particularly well. I think at this budget, the huge...
We can all agree on that.
Yeah. I think the huge missed opportunity at this budget is in terms of not having a stimulus. Now, I was allowing myself to get a bit more hopeful in January. I thought George Osborne might finally be seeing some sense, seeing that, you know, austerity wasn't working, and might be prepared to launch a capital spending intense stimulus. Now, the argument for this is that, you know, the government's borrowing cost at the moment is negative in real terms. You know, if you can find anything that's got any sort of positive return, this is self-financing over the cycle. And because it's capital spending, it doesn't affect his primary target, the structural deficit. Now, I thought after we'd lost the AAA rating, after he'd announced he was already going to miss his fiscal targets, after the IMF was saying this was a good idea, the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, I think the British Chamber of Commerce is now in favour of the TUC, the Economist magazine came out in favour a week ago. I thought there was such a head of steam building up, the business secretary as well, that we might finally get this. But the Chancellor is not prepared to do it. And I think actually...
Are you sure?
I think he's not prepared to do it, because I think he's trapped himself. I think we should remember George Osborne has two jobs. He is Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he's the election coordinator for the Conservative Party. And I think as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he can see that borrowing to invest in capital projects is a good idea, but as election coordinator of the Conservative Party, he doesn't want to concede this argument. He thinks the moment he backs away from, you know, says anything I was wrong, he concedes a political argument, and I think he's trapped himself. I think his rhetoric has trapped himself, and he's now doing something that is not right for the economy.
Just very quickly, Andrew.
I think that mischaracterises things. I agree that he's trapped himself, but not in that way. The government's original strategy did not require them to cut capital spending. The capital spending cuts which they made were those scheduled by Alistair Darling before he came into office. What they announced was cuts to current spending. So it should never have been politically problematic for them to have reversed out of that. The only reason that that's become politically problematic is that everybody has attacked their capital spending cuts as if they were theirs, and that they've said any change in that means that you're abandoning your whole plan. Even though that wasn't his plan. So what has happened is that he has been placed into this position partly because he didn't want to focus at the start on the right sort of spending cuts and actually claim that they were virtuous, but instead to talk about how he's cut the deficit by a quarter, even though the cuts in the deficit aren't anything very much to do with his own, mainly not to do with his own plans. And as, because he's been pressed on this point so vigorously by the Labour Party and by the commentariat, he now feels as if any manoeuvre on this is in fact the reversal of his policy, even though it wasn't. However, he has tried to move on these things a little bit. He tried, for example, to announce an extra $5 billion of capital spending rises in the autumn statement. Vince Cable has tried to say, look, we could increase capital spending without that changing our plans at all in a recent article in the New Statesman. So I think that he's trying to achieve some wiggle room on this point. What my concern would be, if you start to shift when you haven't really achieved any current spending cuts, if you start to shift on any spending at all, whilst at the same time you've got these massive ring-fenced departments and there's a lot of resentment about that, people will start saying, look, everyone else... Right, everyone else. So these other departments, the NHS, the schools and so on, they don't have to make any spending cuts. The capital guys, they don't have to make any spending cuts. Why is everything landing on us? And I think that there would be a serious risk of the entire programme unravelling at that point.
I think there's going to be one hell of a cabinet battle over the spending round. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, the cabinet people like Theresa May, Vince Cable, the people who are in the unprotected departments are going to absolutely kick up a storm over the size of the cuts they're expected to make. So the budget may actually pass by relatively benignly, but the spending round is going to be a bloody fight between George Osborne and what people call the National Union of Ministers. They are going to really, really kick up a fight, I think, about it. So the budget is probably not the big political event in the next few months. The spending round in June is going to be where the real action is going to be.
Although at the budget, we will presumably find out the overall spending totals before they're clarified in June. So, you know, that I think actually that might be, you know, the big news from the budget might not be the sort of more of the same stuff we're going to get. It might be what's happening to the Bank of England remit and the overall spending total stretched out, you know, beyond the current.
I mean,
period.
I think there's a real political risk for Osborne here, which is that you can imagine a scenario where the budget doesn't go down too well. People think it's a bit of a damp squib, that the first quarter GDP figures come out in late April and they're again very poor, and potentially Britain could be in a triple dip recession, which would be unprecedented. And then there's the local government elections in early May, which the Conservatives are actually defending a lot of seats that they won in 2009. Mm-hmm. So they're going to almost certainly lose a bunch of bunch of council seats, and you can see then that the pressure really starts to ratchet up on Osborne. And I think that, you know, Andrew's point about, you know, 1972 is a quite well made one. I think that, you know, what Osborne really is petrified of, and it's sort of Tory folklore, is they don't want to be seen as doing a Heath style U-turn, which is what he did in early 1972, and that he sees himself as a sort of heir of Geoffrey Howe, which in the early 1980s, when Geoffrey Howe stuck the course and fiscal policy was kept very tight, and monetary policy then did actually take up the slack. The difference, though, then was that interest rates were very high and you could cut them a long way, and the pound was excessively high and you could cut that could fall an awful long way, and the oil price was very high and that came down a lot. So you had three big positive shocks to the economy. It's hard to see where those positive monetary shocks or commodity shocks are going to come from this time. And that's why I think there is a case for saying, you know, even a Conservative Party case for saying, well, let's do something on the fiscal side. I mean, maybe not the capital spending, but let's cut taxes. I mean, let's actually try and get some money into people's pockets. Consumers are really feeling it because of higher inflation. Let's give them a bit more spending power and try and kickstart the economy and get the deficit down that way. But, and I think there will be people on the right of the Conservative Party who'll say, you know, why aren't we actually being a bit more aggressive on the tax cutting side as well as on the capital spending?
What do you think of that one, Andrew? I mean, so clearly you think that the current spending can't be relaxed, but do you think you could stimulate the economy by cutting taxes, or is that just as dangerous?
There are lots of people on the right of the Conservative Party who think exactly that. That's exactly correct. They think that the thing to try is to cut taxes. I also think, and I urged, that the government always should have tried to retain flexibility in terms of what it did about tax cuts. It should have said the key thing is not cutting the deficit, it's cutting the level of spending, because we need to get the spending down so as we can get the medium-term growth rate up. If they'd done that, then they could have had much more flexibility on the side of taxes, because then everything is measured in terms of your achievements on the spending side rather than your achievements on the deficit side. However, I'm very sceptical myself of the idea that this would make a lot of difference. It would feel like something to do, but the reality is that we have such an enormous deficit that the marginal benefit in terms of any stimulus of changing taxes and so on is likely to be very small. At very low deficits, you get quite a lot of oomph to the economy by things like temporary tax cuts. At very large deficits, there's much less oomph, and it's actually likely to be perverse under some circumstances. I think, for example, at the moment, in particular, we've had one downgrade. If we were now to react to a downgrade by relaxing policy further, I think we could see another two downgrades for the UK, and then we could be on a path to multiple downgrades in the style of countries like Ireland and Spain, who lost their AAA ratings only a couple of years ago.
Think it's possible, Duncan?
Well, I think it's worth saying that, you know, it's quite an odd situation, isn't it, that we've got a Conservative Chancellor who's not prepared to do the fairly conventional stuff on fiscal policy, just prepared to do very radical and untested stuff on monetary policy. That's an odd situation to be in. I mean, on the downgrade spiral, you know, I'm afraid I don't buy this. Firstly, I think, you know, our credit rating, you know, making retaining our AAA rating one of the central aims of policy was always a very silly thing to do. I think it's very noticeable that after the downgrade, after Moody's downgraded us, interest rates haven't particularly reacted in a way they didn't react when the US was downgraded in 2010, and they didn't react when France was downgraded in 2011. I think too much store is put by this credit rating. But I think, you know, the difference with Ireland and Spain is we do have our own central bank, we do have our own currency. The deficit would be more of a problem if we were in the euro area, but we're not in the euro area. You know, the Bank of England's already printed £375 billion. I don't see this risk of Britain, you know, soaring interest rates, etc. They're still negative.
I think there is a risk of further downgrades, but only if the economy fails to grow. I mean, I think the real worry for the rating agencies is this sort of nexus of a low growth, zero growth economy, which is feeding through into a higher deficit. And I think that's sort of feeding on itself. And I think that at some point the government has got to break out of that cycle. And I think that, you know, Osborne's wriggle room is rapidly running out, both in terms of the rating agencies and politically, because he's envisaging the situation where the economy recovers this year, that things start to get better, that the rating agencies look at his consolidation plans and say, yes, okay, we've downgraded him once, but that's it. But if you can imagine that if the economy flatlines for another 6 months, then he's going to be in serious economic and political trouble in those circumstances, because it's now only 2 years before the election, and, you know, that people will start to say, you know, this government is on its last legs. You know, so he needs the economy to recover, both because it will get the rating agencies off his back, but more importantly, politically, because, you know, voters are starting to say, you know, you've been in power for 3 years, you own this economy now. You can't blame it all on Gordon Brown and the previous administration. It's your responsibility. And, you know, by this stage, he was envisaging the economy would be steaming ahead at 2.5-3% a year, and it's not, clearly.
If that happens, and then there's inflation, he won't survive as Chancellor.
Duncan, last year was very much George Osborne's omni-shambles. The background to this budget, we've had, you know, yesterday, for example, looks like the Prime Minister's been forced to back down on his plans to put a minimum price on the sale of alcohol. You've got Theresa May kind of giving an alternative agenda as Tory leader, Michael Gove riding to the rescue, but then undermining the Prime Minister on this alcohol plan. There's sort of starting to be rumblings, aren't there? And I'm just wondering if it will be Cameron's problem rather than just Osborne's if the budget doesn't go down well this time.
Well, I think it's very hard to separate the two, to be honest. You know, it's very noticeable that, as far as I'm aware, David Cameron doesn't have his own economic advisor. You know, he's that close to his Chancellor, he didn't feel the need for independent economic advice. And I think maybe after the budget last year, he'd wish there was someone in Number 10 casting an eye over it rather than leaving it to the Treasury. So, you know, I think it's really, really hard to separate the two. I think anything that damages Osborne does damage David Cameron. You know, sometimes I look back at June 2010, and I look back at the initial forecasts that accompanied that budget. And I don't think fundamentally a fiscal plan has been altered since then. The timetable has slipped, but the spending cuts are still programmed in there. You know, it's somebody in the FT described recently those initial forecasts as darkly comic. And I think it's true. You know, if you would...
But they were downgrades, right?
Yes. And if you look at what was happening in June 2010, you know, the forecasts were the economy should have grown by about 2.8% last year rather than 0.3%. Business investment should have grown by 10% rather than 0.4%. The trade deficit should have been falling and adding to growth rather than subtracting to it. It's not just that we haven't had the growth. It's that we haven't had the promised rebalancing either. You know, George Osborne set himself three aims. He set himself eliminate the structural deficit within a parliament. In fact, he was going to do it a year early. That's not going to happen. He said rebalance towards export savings and investment. That's not going to happen. And he also said that the economy would be growing very strongly over the next few years, and that's not going to happen. And actually, a fourth one, he said he'd return AAA, and we've lost that. All of the central aims he set out in his May lecture when he was Shadow Chancellor have now been missed. And this isn't just a problem for him, it's got to be a problem for the Prime Minister as well.
Is that too harsh, Andrew?
What I would point out, that though I agree that the, and said so at the time, that the June 2010 growth forecasts were far too optimistic, I would say two things about that. One was that they were downgrades from the estimates that had only been made by the Treasury 3 months earlier in the March budget.
Labour.
Yeah, that's right. And secondly, my view was always that it was the fact that the economy had such poor growth outlook that made cutting the deficit quickly more urgent. So what a lot of people have done here is that they've blamed the cancer on the operation, right? We have a problem with the economy, and that meant that we needed to react. Then they slowed the rate at which they intervened to correct the problem, and then you blame the fact that the problem persists on your attempt to intervene, which is just all to get things the wrong way around. The second thing I would say about that, I very much agree that Osborne and Cameron's destinies are inextricably linked, or almost inextricably linked. But I would say that that doesn't mean that they survive exactly the same amount of time. Right? So John Major was quite close pals with Norman Lamont, who was his campaign manager when he became the Prime Minister, and they got on quite well for some years, but he was prepared to dispense with him when push came to shove. I think Cameron may hold on to Osborne almost to the last minute, but I don't think you should by any means guarantee that Cameron himself survives until the next election either. Because if the economy continues to look very poor and it looks like there's no prospect of the Conservatives winning the next general election, then I think next year the Conservatives could decide that it may be time up for this particular set of people.
Blimey, a grim warning there. Well, we'll leave things on that dark note. You can follow the budget in real time next Wednesday on guardian.co.uk/politics, and we'll have our verdict in next week's podcast. But now, the continuing dispute between Britain and Argentina over with the Falkland Islands met the ballot box this week. The roughly 2,000 people with a right to vote were asked whether they wanted to remain British. The response was, to put it mildly, one-sided. Jonathan Watts is our Latin American correspondent.
The result was entirely predictable and utterly overwhelming. 99.8% the voters, that is all but three of them, voted in favour of staying British. So it's the kind of result you normally only see in places like North Korea, as Argentina's president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, was very quick to anticipate before the vote.
Just remind us how this referendum came about.
The referendum is the islanders' response to growing pressure from Argentina, which of course sees the islands not as the Falklands but as the Malvinas, and says it has a prior claim to sovereignty and a stronger claim to sovereignty than Britain, dating back, they say, to very early in the 19th century. Of course, after the 1982 war between Britain and Argentina, those claims kind of never disappeared completely, but they died down. There was a period of relative calm. The Argentinian government in the 90s had a peace and a charm offensive to try to win the Falklanders back over. When that didn't appear to be working, in the last 3 or 4 years, the current government, the government of Kirchner, has ramped up the pressure. It's persuaded its South American neighbors to initiate a series of fairly strong steps, including turning away any ships with a Falklands flag and banning some overflights of planes that might go to the Falklands. And so basically it's trying to isolate the Falklands, try to make it much more expensive for them to keep their living standard and to make it more expensive for Britain to maintain their living standard.
So this was a vote really to make a point of defiance to Argentinians. You've already said with Ms. Kirchner this isn't cut the ice, it might have done. But do you think it will have any implications for those sort of ongoing negotiations, or whatever the phrase is, between Britain and Argentina?
Britain has predictably said the results should be respected and it supports the Falklands. Argentina has said, well, Cristina de Kirchner said the result was a parody, and she said that the islanders, in the last few days, she said they're basically their squatters. So the usual rhetoric that we've come to expect in the last couple of years. But where it might make a difference, and in an area that's important, is in the rest of the world. Argentina's made some considerable progress in the last few years in persuading other nations, particularly other nations in Latin America, that they need to be more active in supporting Argentina's claims to sovereignty. The U.S. has been sitting on the fence. And so the Falklanders think that if their voice is shown to be distinct, not just the voice, not just that they're not just following the British government, they say, that they can actually make their own push and try to show this isn't an old colonial issue. They want to try and show it as a human rights issue, as an issue of their self-determination.
And you talked about self-determination there. I guess most of us now, or at least anyone who can't remember the war as an adult, wouldn't know how much autonomy the Falklanders have. Obviously, they're under British military protection, but do they get transfers of money from London? Are they free to vary health, education, everything else as much as they, or as little as they want?
The situation now is that they are becoming more economically independent because there's been a large discovery of oil and gas on the islands. And that means that they don't depend quite so much as before on, well, selling fishing rights, but also on support from the UK. So they're self-sustaining economically, except for their defence budget. And, of course, that's huge. And for that, they depend entirely at the moment on the UK. Some islanders were saying that once the oil money comes on stream, which is expected in 4 years, they'd be willing to contribute towards that expense. But what you can see is that as they're getting more money in, they're becoming more important to potentially to the UK and to Argentina. So the stakes have been raised, but at the same time, their independence has also increased.
The Guardian's Latin American correspondent, Jonathan Watts there. Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Andrew Lillico, Larry Elliott and Duncan Weldon. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. And thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.